Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
That justice system ultimately ignored all of those bodies and all of the families.
The stories they don't want told.
I was one of many people that were victims who was used.
Being lied to, tricked, and traded like a commodity.
Holding the powerful to account.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we are talking about the seeming return of Boko Haram after a massive attack in northern Nigeria. But did the militant Islamist organization, responsible for kidnapping thousands of children, including the Chibok girls, ever really go away?
The level of fatalities experienced during this last attack was so high. So the view of many people is that Boko Haram has actually regrouped and they are becoming more sophisticated because more than 100 people have been declared missing, dead or buried.
And we talk through the dangers and opportunities posed by using artificial intelligence to archive and notate African music. It's Thursday, the 5th of September. First, we go to Kenya. 3 years ago, we were shocked and saddened by the killing of Agnes Tirop, an athlete from Kenya. The following year, Damaris Mutua, also an athlete, also from Kenya, was killed as well. Again, we were shocked and saddened. Today, we heard that Rebecca Cheptegei, who'd recently competed in the Paris Olympic Games, had succumbed to burns she had sustained earlier this week. All these women were world-class champion athletes. All of them died as a result of domestic violence, and their intimate partners are identified as the main suspects. Following the death of Agnes Tirop, her friend Joan Chelimo founded a foundation in her name to try and address the increasing violence against women athletes in Kenya. Of course, violence is not confined to athletes only or women in Kenya alone. It is a worldwide problem. But the brutal killings of young women in their prime has led us to try and understand the threat faced by women athletes. So while investigations continue and the sporting authorities call for stronger protections, I've been speaking to Joan Chelimo, who is herself an athlete, about Rebecca Cheptegei.
Rebecca was a Ugandan athlete. She was a marathon runner. She was also a mom, and she was training in Iten. She was married. And she lived in a place called Endebes. It's like at the border of Kenya and Uganda. Yeah, she was a very nice person. I met her during the Paris Olympics because I was also doing the marathon as her. And we didn't talk much, but she was so passionate. She was so hardworking, like getting her to the Olympics. She was so happy. Yeah, she was so nice. She was so hardworking. Mm. And she was training and living in Iten. And she, yeah.
When was the last time you spoke to her?
When I was in Olympics in Paris.
And you had no idea what was going on in her private life? You didn't see any sign of it?
Sadly, I was not close to her, but I was having an idea because I spoke with a coach. We have a support group with Tirop Angels that we founded after the death of Agnes Tirop, who was brutally murdered by the husband. So we talked to coaches around, just if there's any athlete going through abuse to report to us. Sadly, she just reported to the coach about what she was going through in her marriage, but she was 50-50. She still wanted to go back because the husband convinced her, and it didn't get to Tirop Angels. That's why I was even telling the coach right now that whenever there's any problem, please, you should not handle the case. Send it to us because we have a big team of counselors. We have a team of professionals who would handle any case, because it doesn't just start by just banning someone or murder. It starts by very small things.
And people need to be on the lookout for those things, right? Because Agnes Tirop, tell us about her and why the organization Tirop Angels was started.
After the brutal murder of Agnes Tirop by the husband, it was a wake-up call for all the female athletes in Iten. It was a wake-up call for all the women around here. And I promised myself, me and my friend Viola Lagarde, that we are going to set up a foundation where all the women would come and would just express what they are feeling. Or even if they feel stressed, they can just pick up and say what, if they are going any kind of abuse from their husbands, the coaches, or anyone, report any form of violence. So we set it up, the foundation, since 2021, and it's up and running. We have an office in Iten, and it has been really working so well. We have saved almost 20 women to be killed by the husbands or being taken advantage of. It has been working so well. Of course, we cannot just do everything. Something more needs to be done because, you see, Agnes was murdered. There was another murder that happened, and now we have Rebecca. And it's very sad for us from our point. We are hoping that we are going to work even with the government now and create policies on how we can just help this at least.
We know about three women who were killed brutally by partners. You've just said that you were able to help and rescue about 20 women athletes through the work that you do, and that's just in the last 3 years. Just tell us, is it particularly widespread, this form of violence against women athletes, or is this a reflection of what is going on in broader society?
I would say GBV is just everywhere. It's more high risk here in Iten because it's really part of the culture. I remember even like my grandma's generation. It's cultural, but it's high rise on the sport because we have these young girls who come here and train and they are like teenagers. They travel internationally and they get these athletics earnings and they're being taken advantage of either from someone who will connect them with agents, either from the physiotherapist, or even get married when they're young. It's more because there's talent and there's money. And most of them tend to fall into the hands of these perpetrators because they end up getting married by the wrong people who are looking at them as properties more than just for the sake of love. So they are married just because of what they have, but not because they love them. That is why it's high rise in most of the training camps. I think also most of the men are lazy and they just look for an athlete who has money and they just want to just hold on and just have good cars and just good life. And when the athlete discover themselves, because if they are married when they are very young, when they want to be independent financially or even decision making, when they want to leave the said relationship, that's where the problems start.
It didn't start now, right? I mean, we've had women athletes and the concentration of people training in places like Iten for a long time. Does it seem to be intensifying because more and more athletes are becoming more successful?
More and more athletes are becoming more successful, especially women athletes, especially young moms, because most of them also are moms when they are teens. And when they discover they have the potential and the talent, they tend to work so hard. So I think it just happens. It really breaks my heart. Yeah.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Are you happy for us to continue?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Okay. So it's the rise in women recognizing their strength, their power, their authority, and men not being able to deal with that. Does your work with the Tirop Angels, do you do both rescuing the women and working on the consciousness of the people around the women who are the athletes who are doing this so that it stops? Because it's not a problem for women only, right? It's a problem for society.
Yes. And it was a big challenge for Tirop Angels first to be accepted by the community because the community felt like we were against marriages. So we had that resistance at first. And when we incorporated men into the foundation is when they realized that it is something that is not only about women and defining GBV, what it means. Now we are also working closely with men because we realize when we empower more women, they go out there, even girls, they would meet the men. And that is what we do. So we just do general. We have both male and female.
And what kind of work do you do to try and stop gender-based violence?
Yeah, first we do school visits because I told you this is cultural. So like changing culture, we decided like we'll go to schools. first, so that we educate the young boys and girls. And of course, because it's GBV, it's very sensitive. And we have this program, it's called Don't Touch for schools. We teach them like nobody should touch your private parts, like a song, and just harassment, things not real about murder because they are young. That's one that we do in schools. We also empower women. We have these programs. We call it Chapati Fest. We really empower women who are doing business, who are in the communities, who are victims of GBV, and they have nothing. They have no money to help out their lives. So we have this program, and we really teach them on how they can be independent women. They can just know how to make soap, know how to do beading and then sell it, just to be independent on themselves. Also, we have the program called Beyond the Finish Line. So like we restore the dignity on the kids, because most of the kids go to school and they have torn clothes, they have no shoes. So like we restore the dignity by just having them new clothes from the donations we get. Also, we now do awareness on athletes. We have these programs that we call professionals, from financial people who come and teach women how you organize your finance. We have also a team who comes for physiotherapy to train retired athletes so that they can be massage therapists. Because I'm telling you, in ITEN, there is no one massage therapist who is a female. We felt like most of the girls who would come to us, they have like 3 babies. And we ask, what is the problem? It's like, I didn't have money to get massage and someone took advantage of me. And that's how I'm a mom of 3. So we are like, can we just empower women to be just massage therapists and they can help out? Also, we have a training program for female coaches. It's called the HESCA program. We train coaches, we train male, but also we have a bigger slot for female coaches, so that we want these young athletes who are female to be more comfortable if they're being coached by a female coach. And also, of course, we go to communities. We have many other programs, because, you know, we are based in Elgeyo Marakwet, and female genital mutilation is on high rise. So we go to the communities and talk to them and educate them about the dangers of FGM.
So you're basically pointing to an industry, the athletics industry in Kenya, and the fact that it's dominated by men who are taking advantage of young women. Of course, it's not unique to Kenya. We read often about abuses in other sports like athletics in the US and so on. So it's not unusual. How do people respond to the projects that you bring to them, the programs? For instance, when you're trying to train coaches or young men how to behave towards women, how do they treat you when you go into schools? Are people receptive to these ideas?
To be honest, at first, we had a lot of backlash. We had a lot of resistance from our own people. It took us almost now, it's almost 3 years now, for us to be accepted. We end up being trolled. If you even have my name on Facebook, you'd even meet someone who tells me, Joanne, you're trying to bring up the Western culture, and this is very wrong, because how will we survive if you just want to make these women independent? You are against our marriages. But we decided now to incorporate men in the foundation to do counseling for both female athletes and male athletes. And as I tell you today, even the politicians, when they saw from the political aspect, like we have them coming, we have MCAs and the leaders from around, the chiefs supporting Tirop Angels, is when they change the whole mindset. And now we are so accepted. You cannot imagine, after the death of Rebecca, many people are calling me, how do we help? What can we do? We want to support you, even from the political aspect. So I feel so good. I feel like, though there was a bit of resistance, right now we have been accepted in the community because we incorporated men, and we talked to politicians, who both female and male, and they could come have their talks, and the local chiefs, when we have seminars, when we are creating awareness, they would be make a joke like, these tiny, small girls, what are you trying to do? What are you trying to change our culture from our elders from long, long time ago? Women, the place was just to be in the kitchen and just have babies. And if there was a problem in marriage today, the problem would be the woman.
It would be regarded as her fault. Yeah.
Yes. And violence could be talked even in marketplaces. If there was a neighbor who was beaten up by the husband, you'd find people making jokes about it, talking about it like it's nothing, like a source of entertainment. But now it has changed, because we get even calls even at midnight, people call, there is some violence happening in my estate. That's where we send the police and go and intervene. Before, in Iten, it was just a source of entertainment. People are making jokes about, she's beaten up, you know. It's like really nice stories. It has changed a lot.
You said that more needs to be done. What do you think should be done? I was just thinking that besides, you know, the fact that this is so painful for any woman, any man, it should be as well, to read that somebody was burnt in this way and died, that it should also just be an embarrassment for any society that we can see something like this. And from a country that gives us excellent athletes, do you think that the Kenyan government should feel embarrassed and do something about this, do more?
Yes, yes. First, we need stronger legal protection for female athletes, comprehensive policies that address both physical, psychological abuse, and the government should invest in creating or reporting mechanisms that are safe and confidential and ensuring that the victims can come forward without fear or any relation. It's very essential for the sports federation or sponsors or partners to be held accountable for safety and well-being of the athletes.
Just bring us up to date very quickly with what happened with Agnes Stirrup's husband. He was arrested, and is he still facing trial now?
Yes, but he's out on bail. He's working freely in his village. We are waiting for the sentence. We are hoping that justice will be served.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And my condolences to you and your fellow athletes. Joan Chelimo, athlete and founder of the Agnes Stirrup Foundation. Now, time was when we frequently heard of attacks against communities across northern Nigeria by a group called Boko Haram. Their actual name is Jamaat al-Asuna Lidawa wa al-Jihad. Their intention, since they sprung into violent prominence in the early 2000s, was to replace the government of Nigeria with a caliphate across the north. Their means were violent from the start: kidnappings, car and suicide bombings, relentlessly across the north and sometimes even the capital, Abuja. Several presidents promised to destroy the organization. At its height, Boko Haram kidnapped thousands of children from schools in the northeast, among them the Chibok girls in 2014, many of whom are still missing. Things seem to die down in recent years with smaller, sporadic attacks. This gave rise to the hope that the army, along with civilian militia, had managed to drive Boko Haram out of action. But now they've struck again in the most deadly attack for some time. They attacked a village in Yobe State, with the local police saying it was a revenge attack after two Boko Haram fighters were killed by local vigilantes. Retired Brigadier General Dahiru Abdusalam, security advisor to the governor of Yobe State, gave more details on Focus TV.
At about 4 p.m., when the people were performing the afternoon prayer, Boko Haram insurgents stormed Mafai village. They gathered the people in the mosque, and then after some interaction, they opened fire indiscriminately on the helpless, unarmed, innocent civilians. The situation for now is calm, but it is unpredictable.
The official line is that 34 people were killed, but local sources have suggested the figure could be more than 100. To understand what's happening with Boko Haram, I've been hearing from security analyst and fellow at the London School of Economics, Uche Igwe.
I think that the first thing to talk about is the perception. The perception we have in the country is that the security agencies had an upper hand. But apparently what happened was that Boko Haram people and insurgents were scattered due to the military bombardments. They were displaced apparently from the northeast to other areas like the northwest, other states, Katsina, Kaduna, and Niger states, where they are regrouping as bandits and also carrying similar and often more violent attacks through kidnapping and all sorts of things.
So did this attack surprise everyone? Did it come out of the blue?
It surprised everyone. It surprised many observers because apparently our perception that they have been displaced is not completely correct. It appears that they have started regrouping. And if you look at the 14 years or so of Boko Haram attacks, the level of fatalities experienced in Yobe State during this last attack was so high, apparently one of the highest since Boko Haram insurgency started. So the view of many people is that Boko Haram has actually regrouped and they are becoming more sophisticated, because the last count, more than 100 people have been declared missing, dead or buried. So the fatalities are really high.
Why would that be the case? Is it because the security forces have not been able to rout them completely, or is it that Boko Haram is much more resilient than people thought?
I think it is the latter. Boko Haram is much more resilient than people thought. The whole thinking that they have been really routed out and defeated is not completely true. What is clear is that either as Boko Haram themselves or as bandits or as kidnappers, they are connecting with other violent groups outside the country. And apparently they have military supplies, they have weapons, and they are increasingly daring and more sophisticated, more than we all thought.
There were groups that were armed by the security forces to help fight Boko Haram. And according to reports, this attack is said to have been in retaliation after two Boko Haram fighters were killed. Just remind us about what is being called vigilante groups, you know, the other groups.
They called the civilian JTF.
That's right.
And the civilian JTF is basically a group of villagers who actually know some of these Boko Haram fighters because they were originally part of them in the communities before they, you know, joined Boko Haram and went to the bush, and from there they were launching attacks. So some of these civilian JTF people were actually acting as informants to the military, informing them of these persons, of their locations, because sometimes when they carry out these attacks, they come back into the community to see their families, their wives, their children and everything. So the civilian JTF, they were providing the information to the military. But again, what it means is that the military have shown lack of capability to protect this, you know, this, their informants and the civilian JTF. That is what this attack in Yobe State exposed. So by, in return to the information they received from civilian JTF, the military ought to protect them, because if you recall, before now, when some of these civilian JTF people brought the information to the security agencies, and when these Boko Haram people get released one way or the other, they come back and carry this retaliatory attack. So it is not surprising that the civilian JTF people are on the receiving side of Boko Haram violence. But what is surprising is that the military and the security agencies grossly failed to protect them.
How effective were they in actually helping to fight Boko Haram, this joint task force? Because we used to hear that they were not properly equipped, they didn't have proper weapons, they didn't even have proper boots. So how much did they actually help?
Well, the most important part of the fight against Boko Haram, because these Boko Haram people are former community members, and it's obvious that from the issues we hear about the military, about the difficulties in the terrain, the military needed and still needs a lot of intelligence. So that is the value of these civilian JTF people, not necessarily in fighting Boko Haram, but in providing intelligence. So the role of the military is to protect them in return.
Previous governments in Nigeria have faced criticism for not arming the military properly to fight Boko Haram, not having the political will to do so. President Bola Tinubu has been in power for about a year or so. What is his strategy for fighting Boko Haram?
Well, every president that has been elected since Boko Haram started as part of their campaign, always assure Nigerians of security. And to be fair to the current president, he made a few changes in the military high command as soon as he took power. So our expectation as citizens is that there will be an increased pushback on Boko Haram, bandits, kidnappers, and insecurity in general, especially in the North Central, in the Northeast, and in the Northwest. But I think that the results we are seeing do not match our expectations as these attacks continue. So that is the only way to justify or to rate and appraise the commitment, the political will, is the kind of results we get. Unfortunately, these attacks continue. Many of them, like what happened in Yobe State, are brazen. So security analysts find it difficult to see the kind of improvement that President Bola Tinubu assured us and promised.
All right, then. Thank you very, very much. That's been really interesting talking to you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Cheers. That's the security analyst and researcher at the London School of Economics, Uche Igwe. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
That justice system ultimately ignored all of those bodies and all of the families.
The stories they don't want told.
I was one of many people that were victims who was used.
Being lied to, tricked, and treated like a commodity.
Holding the powerful to account.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
JustPlay is a music metadata and intelligence company with a strict focus on African music. You know, archive data on African music with the goal of making them available to software developers, researchers, and all sorts of engineers, especially where we need higher intelligence on African music to serve the African audience.
That's the current president of the African Music Library and CEO of JustPlay, Emmanuel Ogala. We'll hear more from him in just a minute. Producers like him are beginning to apply artificial intelligence in the music industry across the continent, not just in making sounds, but also for storing or archiving music. This comes against the background of music from Africa being bundled under the label World Music, or the generic label of African music, without recognizing the depth and variety of sounds across the continent. This is where artificial intelligence comes in, perhaps to fill in the gaps of knowledge, but also to provide access to the music. But the power and reach of artificial intelligence can do good, and it can do damage. There are particular fears that it could disenfranchise musicians, robbing them of income and ownership. How realistic are those fears, though? Will AI help or hinder African music production? Let's hear from Emmanuel.
The world has always seen African music as a single entity. It's not. African music is very diverse and very complex. In fact, there's no such thing as African music as a genre. There are over 138 genres that we've documented at JustPlay with sizable number of audiences. They have their own quirks, they have their own nuances, and they are complex in their own right and deserve to be studied in their own right.
What do you use artificial intelligence for?
Artificial intelligence is very critical to what we're doing. Being able to annotate these songs to say, you know, this is all the properties they have, is not possible with humans. And so we have to train a lot of AI models to understand what we want and then pass our data through them. And then they have them annotated to give us the final data that we can then use in making these decisions.
But it's been done by humans up to now.
Yes, I agree with you. It's been done by DJs. It's been done by a lot of music curators. But it's not just possible to do it at the scale that we do it, when there are millions and millions of songs to look at. And one of the challenges also we face with music in Africa is most of our problems have always been solved by people in the West. And they always see African music as African music. Up until recently, it was only one genre, world music, that described everything that wasn't Western. And then recently we have African music to describe everything African. But African music is so diverse from Cape Verde to Mauritius. You know, there are just too many genres in Africa that a lot of people enjoy that cannot be just classed as African music.
I mean, AI is only going to go by what it knows and what it has, in the sense of it will only know as much as is available to it. Now, if we're saying that there isn't a lot of information around for AI to make those decisions, how do we ensure that this particular machine, because it is machine learning, is accurate?
First of all, the human knowledge. We source the humans who are experts. The process is you transform what the human knows into AI, and then the AI does what it does, brings back results. The human reviews, is it correct? Is it not correct? What's correct? What's wrong? We feed that back. So we have that continuous feedback loop that continues training the AI. And so it takes time and data back and forth. And after a couple of training sessions, the AI becomes quite as good as the human.
Well, I suppose the question would then be, so why do we need the AI? But Tabu Osusa is a Kenyan musician, and I have a quote here from him. He's worried about ownership. He says, once you take music from Ghana or Nigeria, who owns the music? How would you find out where the original creators are and ensure that they are credited? And he says, actually, it's theft through the back door.
I see that. If you really don't understand how it works, you think that's possible. But
I think that's most people in the world who don't quite understand how it works and only see it as a process that robs them of something. It's a serious concern.
Yeah, it's a very serious concern. And what we do is we keep both editorial and contextual metadata. And so editorial metadata tells us who did what and when, you know, who was the musician behind this, who's the producer, who's the songwriter, who's the shekere player.
This is another quote from Tabu Osusa. He says, people don't study music in Africa. They're born with it and live it. It's spiritual. Mm-hmm. And it's always alive. It changes over time. It's dynamic. And I think the fear for him is that AI would sort of freeze or cement music, and he feels that it will be taken away from African musicians. Seems like people feel like AI is stealing something from them.
Yes, people do feel that way, but I feel differently. I look at AI as a tool and not the product. AI can make music. And I see where that fear is coming from, because recently there's been the hype about GPTs, which can transform text to a full music. Right. And then if I, who's not a musician, for instance, can just use text to generate music, then it begins to compete with the musician who does music on a daily basis as a living. And that competition is what most people are afraid of. I see AI as a tool. GPT is just a very tiny bit of the AI world. Anybody that makes music right now and record music, if you use any software to make music right now, you generate a lot of tones, you generate sections of music. These have all been done with algorithms for quite a long time. I also worry for African music, because as part of our documentation, we up until the 2000s, you could document someone who plays a shekere, for instance, or a bata drum player, or a conga player, something very African and unique. But right now, in most music that are made these days, you don't find those. Those players, those human elements in making music don't exist, because they are digitally produced by some sort of algorithm. But the future I see also is that it's going to breed some kind of new skills within the African music industry, in the sense that I don't believe AI can make any genre in African music as good as the humans who really do them, because AI depends on human knowledge.
There are also fears about people losing not just the skills of, for instance, having a shekere player, and if there's AI that can do it, why train somebody to do it themselves? But also just the economics of it. So unregulated sampling methods, which will enable recording companies in the West to make money while leaving some creatives in African villages to languish, which is not just a problem that might become prevalent because of AI. It's a problem in general, isn't it, for African creatives, where people do use their creative capital and make money out of it without them being able to do it. How do you address that? You know, royalties is a big issue.
Yes, royalty is a big issue. And, you know, the AI development has developed faster than how we initially conceived of licensing and royalty. But first, people are able to steal because we are not represented at the table, at the global music industry data table, where if I use a sample in my music, right, a radio station, for instance, in the West, are able to identify the music they are using just by running a software that listens to their, you know, their playlist that they are playing. And royalty is then disbursed later on. And so, you know, part of what we do is also the ability to identify where these samples have been used. If a sample is used in Canada, for instance, a radio station in Canada should be able to run a software, a standby software that just listens to their music and is able to tell you, okay, this actual record belongs to person A, but this record contains sample from another artist, and that artist is, you know, B. That artist could be African. But if that software does not have this metadata we're talking about, then that becomes impossible. The metadata, it can only, you know, make decisions based on what it knows, based on what's in this database. And right now, Africans are not, you know, very much represented in the digital world of music.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
That's Emmanuel Ogala, current president of the African Music Library and the CEO of Just Play. Focus on Africa was put together by Bella Hassan, Rob Wilson and Claudia Efemini here in London. Frenny Joey brought it from Nairobi. Kani Sharp was our senior journalist in charge of quality. Nick Randell was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown and we'll talk again next time.
That justice system ultimately ignored all of those bodies and all of the families.
The stories they don't want told.
I was one of many people that were victims who was used.
Being lied to, tricked, and traded like a commodity.
Holding the powerful to account.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.